So 2792, which is a measure regarding senior property tax relief, and it will also incorporate amendments from House Bill 3022. Looking at it close, would you like to step forward and present the revised idea?
Thank you, Chair Strubeck and members of the Revenue Committee, for letting us return for the second hearing. And Betsy Close, State Representative in District 36. I'd like to commend Chair Strobeck for working with Representative Atkinson and myself to improve House Bill 2792. The dash two amendments, I believe you have in your hands, changed the bill considerably. To summarize them, we changed the property tax credit to be taken as a rebate on state income tax. I believe that's Section 5.1, page 4. We have added a joint income cap of $36,000. That's in Section 6, 2C, page 6. We required a filing deadline of July 1st. That's in Section 5, page 4, line 14. But we've allowed a late rebate filing date of December 31st with a late fee to be determined by the committee. That's in Section 5. The rebate is to be a credit towards the next property tax statement. That's Section 6. That's Section 3C. The Department of Revenue pays the county treasurer the amount certified. And the program shall be called the Senior Property Tax Rebate Act, Section 2. And we received a revenue impact statement from legislative revenue of from $10.2 million to $11.2 million. Based on approximately 250,000 elderly with incomes of $36,000 a year. Because the elderly move to other housing and pass away, I believe these numbers may be slightly high. Again, our goal is to honor our seniors who are many times on fixed incomes. They have worked their fields, managed their businesses, fought our wars, paid their taxes for decades, and blessed all of us. So we'd like to honor them and give them a stable economic future. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Atkinson.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Representative District 51. I apologize for my tardiness. Representative Close and I have put together what we believe is a good bill. Actually, I think what we did is we took a good bill and made it an excellent bill. I'm not sure exactly what you've covered in your remarks. I think I could safely say that this stuff is better than the gut, and so here we are. As she said, what we've done, I think, pretty safely is taken Chair Strobeck's comments and suggestions and incorporate them into such a way that we wouldn't be hurting cities and counties, and still at the same time helping the people who we targeted the original bill to do, which is senior citizens. And I think that from the tail end of Representative Close's remarks, that she covered all the salient points, and with that, I would be more than happy to answer your questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? And Merkley?
Representative Atkinson, is this where the expression good stuff comes from?
Yes, Representative Merkley, and I'm glad that you're asking questions. I didn't know if you were a morning question asker or an afternoon question asker.
It's probably not surprising to discover the answer is both.
Again, what we did is originally we had a bill that would help senior citizens who were on a fixed income, but their expenses weren't necessarily fixed. And we came, as you recall, several weeks ago with the bill. And this bill actually takes an idea that was used in the early 80s and dresses it up to 1999 with the same intent. So I'm really pleased with what the dash twos will do.
I appreciate your working on this. There's a couple of questions that I had about, I think, what we have discussed and maybe how this came out. Perhaps we could ask Elizabeth, because the analysis talks about closing value, and I think that was one of the things that I said would appear to me to be a problem for administration, at least by the counties, and I thought that was one of the components that we were talking about taking out of this bill. And having the taxes continue to, property taxes continue to be unfrozen, but that this rebate would pay back a portion of the tax that the homeowner paid. And it appears that that the amendments still have that freeze provision in them.
Chairman Strobeck, what the counties would do, I mean, they would still be calculating that assessed value, and what they would be basing their property taxes on would be the assessed value. But what's being rebated is that amount that's the increase in the frozen value. I mean, that frozen value term is still right in, you know, page 2, subsection 3. You know, what it means is the assessed value of the principal for whichever is the later of the tax year that they come on. So it's still in there, and then the thing that was changed too was that any additions that would be put on the house, so like if they did any remodeling or anything, then your frozen value would change, which is a change from the original bill. But you're still going to have a frozen value. That's what's going to determine the rebate that comes from the Department of Revenue.
Why wouldn't it be possible to not have a frozen value and to just say that the rebate is a percentage of the tax paid by a qualifying senior?
Chairman Strobeck, you can do that, but this is not the way this is.
I think that would be easier to administer. And I guess another question I have is why the tax would be applied to the credit on the next tax year rather than simply as a refund check like you get a tax refund. Is that another operational issue just with the amendment?
Okay, well, as they were saying, that next year, you know, they're going to be applying for it, and then it comes off next year's income tax, and it becomes a rebate that they can have in the following year. But you're suggesting to...
say that again. I thought you said it would be applied to the next...
property tax
year.
Right.
Sure, Strobeck. If I may, we discussed that with Legislative Council, and that was their idea that would be the easiest way to do this, but to be applied to the next year's taxes. So I asked about cutting checks, and you felt that was the more expensive way to go. Is that your interpretation?
Yeah, correct. And I think that with the conversation that we had, employing the word frozen value and having it under the auspice of a rebate, in the next year, I thought that we addressed both of the concerns. I know what you're saying, but I think that the way the conversation we had with Legislative Council as far as administration goes, that the rebate would still, the process would still be the same.
I guess the reason that I was objecting or concerned about the frozen value was just in terms of the functioning of the counties, that they would then have to maintain a separate set of books that says, here's a house that, you know, this one's going up. The taxes can go up by 3% a year, but the one next door can't because it's occupied by a senior, and that's where I thought the attaching this to the income tax to show residence as well as income was a nice way of sort of pre-qualifying everyone who is eligible.
That's true.
You think so, Jeremy?
I have a mechanical question. I'm just looking at these for the first time. Just wondering about Section 4 of the dash 2 amendments, beginning at the bottom of page 3 and going to the top of page 4, that upon compliance with Section 2 to 10, the Department of Revenue shall pay a portion of the property tax imposed on the principal residence. In Section 5, it says the property owner seeking the senior citizen principal residence property tax rebate with respect to this. How do those components work together? In the one section, it says the Department of Revenue is paying a portion of the property tax, and I assume that payment is to the county.
Right.
And then the next section, it talks about a rebate, which I would assume would be to the senior citizen, to the taxpayer, and I'm not sure how those two sections coordinate.
Well, again, my thinking on this bill, Representative Shetterly, was that the Department of Revenue would not get involved in any way in writing checks to the counties, but that the homeowner would write the check to the county.
In Section 4 appears to have the Department of Revenue paying tax to the county.
Yeah, certainly looks that way. Mr. Riddell, did you have something to add on this? Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
I believe we had in the bill before a definition of household income, and it's probably in here now, but I'm searching in vain for it. Could you
clarify that? Chair Skrobeck, Representative Merkley, I believe on the bottom of page 2 it says household income has the meaning given that term under RRS 310.630.
Okay. Does that include the income of children or relatives or everyone who's living under the roof as it is?
Chair Skrobeck, Representative Merkley, we discussed that with Legislative Council. It was our decision to have it a joint husband-wife income, or excluding the children.
Let me pose a question this way then. If I have a significant residence and I invite my parents to live with me or my parent, could I put the house in their name and thereby freeze my property taxes?
No, because... okay. No, that's... We talked about that as far as in the amendment. I think we go to the ORS that defines the resident, and you know, and I think the opposite, and Chair Skrobeck probably helped me here. I think that the opposite would be true if a senior citizen had a family member living with them. Still, again, it's the person who owns the house, the senior citizen who owns the house, and the senior citizen's income. Those are the two tasks.
Representative, it just been pointed out to me that on page 6, further clarifies the income. At the top of the page says that the household income of all persons residing at the principal residence is not exceed $36,000, so it doesn't really matter who has the income.
Okay.
In that case, as long as it's the senior that's the homeowner.
Yeah. I would make a note that this may be covered under page 5 at the top, where it notes the household income of the applicant and, if applicable, the spouse of the applicant. It's a little confusing as to whether that means the applicant and the applicant's spouse's income, or whether the household income would already cover everything that's defined on the following page. A question.
I think we've got a little more work to do with the amendments, but I really think this is a much cleaner way of accomplishing your goal, which is to provide some relief for folks who are feeling taxed out of their homes, and that's especially the bottom line on this. So I think we'll meet offline and work on this a little more.
Okay.
Thank you very much. You can. You're welcome, sir, to go ahead and talk about the assessor issue, though, if you want.
Chairman Strobeck, members of the committee, I'm Mark Noakes, the Bend County Assessor and Tax Collector, as well as President of the Assessors Association and Tax Collectors Association. As with any bill, I'm starting to look at them from an administrative standpoint. I have not had a chance to thoroughly look at these amendments, and I have expressed some concern prior to this meeting with Lizbeth about the meanings of terminology in regards to Measure 50. And as it's been said before, it gives us all a headache, and we need to be very careful, I think, when we start freezing values in assessed values, especially, which in a non-frozen state changes every year for us. And that was the concern that I wanted to express, that administratively this doesn't seem to lend itself to be easily understood as it's currently written. And we would appreciate having some input on that.
Right, and I recognize that. That was part of, I think, what we discussed is the original issues regarding the bill as it was first drafted. And as I just expressed a couple of minutes ago, I'd like to get it so we don't have that frozen component in the measure at all.
and that would take care of your problem.
Thank you.
Let's see. Also on this bill, in McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. The amendments really seem to deal with the concern that we would have had without them, which is that taking property tax dollars from cities doesn't help senior citizens, doesn't help any other residents of the community. Without having a chance to really read through the amendments, it appears that you've dealt with that and looks like it has the potential to be a win-win.
Very good. We've heard you before. We don't want to have another Bash Cities Day here.
Wonderful.
Are there any questions? Thank you. Lisa, could you now tell us about the, I believe the concepts of 3022 have been molded into another amendment, so we're pushing one down.
Okay. In Dash 4 of this 2792, we incorporated the income level changes for the senior deferral program that were in House Bill 3022 and just brought them into this bill just in case you wanted to have just one bill dealing with senior issues, then this is what you could do, and we've just incorporated them in here in the Dash 4. So all the Dash 4 is the senior deferral income changes. And Representative Witt was talking about yesterday in a disabled bill, there's an income change from $24,500 to $27,500 to qualify for the senior deferral program. And then there's an increase from $29,000 to $32,000 to remain on the senior deferral program. And I also got some new numbers as far as the senior deferral program, which might be kind of helpful for you as far as seeing the balance that there is currently in that program. And these are from the research staff at Department of Revenue. So if you, there's this handout here with the table of the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. And in there you can see from 1982 to 93 to all the way to the year 2002 to 2003, all the different payments to counties, the number of counts, total amount deferred, the average payment per taxpayer, and then the yearly balance of repayments to counties versus the amount that repayments from people on the program versus the payments to counties. So we can see from that chart that in recent years, and what is projected is that there will be a positive balance of about $4.7 million in 1999, 2000, $3.8 million, in 2000 and around $3 million in 2001, 2 and about $2.4 million in 2002 to 2003. So there is a balance with the Senior Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program, and if we increase these limits to the program, it's still going to have a balance. But there will be new participants. It's assumed that about 1,400 additional seniors each year entering the deferral program, and approximately $2 million a year would be additional tax payments to counties. But if we just look at these forecasts and then incorporate in the revenue impact from that, we see that the deferral program still would have an account balance in the positive, meaning there would not need to be any general fund money for this increase in these limits.
Okay. And this, these are the same rates that we talked about yesterday with the disabled program for deferrals.
And the rates will be indexed again to adjust for reflections in the consumer price index.
Chair.
Chair Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, I'm not totally clear, though. Does this revenue statement incorporate the creation of the new program in the bill that we did
yesterday?
Before yesterday?
No.
So would there be general fund monies needed if we were raising the threshold for seniors as well as creating that new program?
Yeah, that didn't seem like that was reflected in anything. Yeah, yesterday I didn't have these new numbers as far as, you know, just what was the balance for that particular senior deferral program. And if you, the balance after this particular bill impact, we would have about $1.9 million, say, in the year 2000-2001. But that the disabled program had about $3 million that was going to be revenue impact each year that was forecast. So if we looked at that, then yes, then that would mean that you'd need about $1 million in general fund money if you combined the two.
Well, I think that's the way we need to look at it, collectively. Okay, any other comments? Okay, we're going to have the first set of amendments redrafted so that they more closely represent our intent, and then we'll visit this measure again. Is anyone else here to speak on 2792? Not, we'll close public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2811. Mr. Don Hefner, you want to tell us where we are on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. We've had a number of conversations in the last week or so with officials from Department of Transportation and Department of Administrative Services, and I think we've settled on a set of amendments, which are your DASH 4 amendments, which are hopefully before you today. These provide that the future estimates will be based on a survey. The survey will be conducted by an independent third party out of the System of Higher Education. We've used the Survey Research Center at OSU before. There may be other survey branches within state higher ed. It provides that the survey will be the basis for the estimate. It provides that the estimate will be based on the daily typical consumption and total consumption of motor boats, and then the number determined from that survey will be used for the next 3 years, and we'll repeat surveys every 4. And the current survey that was just completed will be the basis for transfers starting this July 15th. So the next survey would be 2003.
You're okay with that, and ODOT's okay with that at this point? And where does it say, I know it says here the first survey, actually about up to 2003, where does it say that it'll be a continuing 4-year event?
Oh, actually, in section 2A, right. Page 1, line 9 and 10.
Survey should be conducted once every 4 years.
Okay. I think this avoids the constitutional issue that was raised with the fixed percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And it also avoids the need to return with the sunset clause and having to revisit this issue in subsequent legislation.
And also saves your, at least half your survey costs, not having to do it every 2 years. Sounds like a good solution. Dick, do you have anything to add?
I think that describes the amendment. The other set of amendments we had were trying to maintain the 1.46% in the bill and at the same time clean up some of the problems. In that case, you run into you're dealing with a percentage of actual collections, and so you don't know the actual collections by July 15th, so we had to provide for 2 payments. One, July 15th for the first 10 months of the year, and then a September 15th payment for the last 2 months of the year. And then it also puts the emergency clause on, and some cases in 6 years.
Okay. Any other comments? Mr. Wilk?
Mr. Chair, I would move House, the amendments, Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 28.
Representative Wilkes moves adoption of the Dash 4 Amendment to House Bill 2411. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Is that what I said? 28? I'm sorry, dash 4 amendments to 2811. There you go. They are adopted.
Chair.
Representative Welch.
I move House Bill 2811 as amendment to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Welch moves House Bill 2811 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Sikori.
Aye.
Representative Murphy.
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Federley.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Green.
Aye.
Representative Rich.
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson.
Excuse.
Chair Strobeck.
Aye. Bill 2811 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Ms. Lux, I'd like to carry it. Thank you, Mr. John Heffner. I'll close the work session on Bill 2811. Thank you, Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And open public hearing on House Bill 2079. Gwen?
Good morning. Chair Strobeck, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton from the Oregon Healthcare Association, Food Hospital 2079. You have already heard testimony on this bill last week, and so with your permission, I will get the highlights of the bill, talk about its current status, and answer any remaining questions you may have about the bill. As you may recall, this is a bill that provides for a property tax exemption for long-term care facilities that have a very high Medicaid census. The bill establishes that level at 70% Medicaid. The reason that we've brought this bill before you is because Medicaid traditionally has not kept up with inflation and the increasing cost to provide long-term health care. And this problem has become even more acute as the minimum wage has gone up. 70% of the average long-term care facility's expenses are labor. In the last year, they've seen wages go up by between 12 and 15%. While the recommended increase in the Medicaid reimbursement rate is at 2% currently in the governor's budget, and historically it has always been less than the increase in cost. So those who rely heavily on Medicaid as a source of revenue are increasingly squeezed and have very little ability to find those revenues from other sources because at least 70% of it is Medicaid. And above and beyond that, you're looking at Medicare, which has been the subject of its own cost-cutting measures. And there's a very small percentage of private pay that, frankly, there's limited ability to increase that amount. It's already high, and if you increase it any higher, really all you do is cause those people to impoverish themselves even more quickly and send down to Medicaid, and then there you are relying again on more Medicaid revenues. And our concern with that is on two levels. We're always concerned with the financial viability of businesses. You want people to be able to stay in business. But the consequence of lack of financial viability for long-term care facilities is greater than just the economic viability of any business. You're looking at problems in access to long-term health care. If a facility either goes under or decides not to take Medicaid because they can't make a go of it on Medicaid, and the people that must rely on Medicaid in that community may not have another facility to go to. This is more of a concern in the rural and semi-rural areas than it probably is in the urban areas. But nonetheless, we want to make sure that there is some place for people to go in their community. And long-term care is unique in the sense that it's where people live as well as where they get health care. So you have someone who wants to stay in the place where they live. They want to stay where their social structures are, their family, their church, their community, all the things that are important to them. So we don't want those people to be forced to go outside of their community to receive care. That's why we're before you with this bill. But, frankly, you don't have to agree with anything I just said, because there are dash one amendments that have been proposed by us that makes it a local option. So it doesn't have any effect on any region unless the local taxing districts decide to adopt it. So those who support this property tax exemption must go to the counties, the cities, any taxing districts, and impress upon them the need for this exemption. And that way, areas where there is a pressing need and where there really are financial viability problems can decide to adopt it. Areas where perhaps there aren't, don't have to. And last time I was here, I gave you an example of a region that may want to adopt it. We have a member who has been asked by a local community to open a facility because there's a pressing need for it. But when it would be a high Medicaid transfer facility, and when he added up the numbers, he couldn't do it. He couldn't make it financially viable, so he had to say no. If this bill passes, he will go back to those local taxing districts and encourage them to adopt this, and likely they will, and he'll be able to open the facility. So, at the end of the last hearing, we were left with some questions about the Dash 1 Amendment and their wording and whether that was really the way that we should be doing it. The answer to that question is yes. We have talked to legislative council, we talked to representatives of local government, and we all agree that the current wording is the appropriate wording. The concern with it is it appears to present many hoops for supporters of the exemption to jump through, because they have to go to every taxing district that is impacted by the exemption. That would be the county, the city, any school district, any other special district. And in talking to Dexter Johnson at legislative council, we all agree that's the way it's done in statute now. This is not a new idea, and that's the way it should be done. So we're willing to accept those extra hoops. We think it's we're willing to jump through them. It's important enough for us to jump through them, and so we will. So this is before you, I think, with consensus among those who have an interest in the bill, and we would encourage you to adopt.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Witt?
Thank you. Is there any reason why this bill's provisions also don't apply to adult foster homes?
That issue was, we don't have any objection to having it apply to adult foster homes. My understanding is there is another bill that does apply it to adult foster homes that's out there. I don't know what its status is. It hasn't been one that we've been working on. So that idea is out there and is contained in a bill. One of the concerns, I think, or issues that this committee will have to address in the context of adult foster homes is there are a great number of them. There's close to 2,000 adult foster homes. And so you would be looking at a far greater impact, I think, by including them, but we certainly have no objection to doing it.
Yes. Would it be true to say that adult foster homes in a similar fashion are providing long-term care to low-income citizens? In other words, if this program is designed to provide some assistance, some tax assistance, or alleviate some tax burden on those who are providing long-term care to Medicaid patients, is it true to say that adult foster homes would be equally participating in providing that care along with the organizations that are specifically mentioned in this bill?
Yes, sure, that's Representative Witt. Yes, in the sense that adult foster homes, like all long-term care facilities, rely on Medicaid as a purchaser of its services. I cannot tell you what level of Medicaid, reliance on Medicaid there is among the adult foster homes as compared to assisted living residential care and nursing facilities, but I know that Medicaid is the largest purchaser of long-term care services across the board.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Excuse me. I just wanted to follow up a little on the local option aspect of this, because one concern I would have is that it seems like local taxing districts that don't have a lot of property taxes may have trouble affording a reduction, and would that necessarily, I mean, the need may be just as great in some very poor communities where they're not particularly property-rich local districts.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this working out equitably for facilities that are located in districts like that?
For sure, that Representative Rosenbaum, that's always an issue, whether or not a local entity can afford to do something that everyone agrees is the right thing to do. And that issue appears in many, many contexts. And the only thing that I can offer you in that respect is to talk about the kind of financial impact that we're likely talking about on individual household levels. These are estimates, and by no means guaranteed number. No individual county should be looking at a huge financial impact. For example, Clackamas County has a number of facilities, and we estimate that if all the facilities that would qualify do have our exemptive property tax, they'd be looking at an impact of about $98,000 total. And I don't know how that would be spread across the various taxing districts, but that's the total property tax impact. And the smaller, more rural counties would have a much less lower impact on that. That's a partial answer to your question. It may be that even any impact is too much for some very poor rural counties. But that's a decision that they will have to make, frankly. Whether or not the impact of a loss of a facility on their low-income residents is enough of a, has enough of a negative impact on those people to make it worth their while.
Does this local option apply only to the local government portion of the property taxes, or is it their entire property tax burden?
The local option applies to the taxes of all taxing districts that would be affected by an exemption.
Does that include the school's portion of the property tax?
Representative Rosenwald, yes, it could.
Would.
Right.
So there is also an impact to the state general fund when it's granted at a local level.
Yes. Although we imagine that impact would be fairly small because a school taxing district does not traditionally carry the heaviest burden of the property tax in any given region.
Chairman?
Just to piggyback on that question, I guess about the revenue impact statement, and it indicates that in the dash ones, no state revenue impact. There would be some indeterminate impact, wouldn't there, based on that last exchange?
Yeah, Representative Shetterly, I mean, every time you're going to have an exemption, whether there's less property taxes than that particular school, you know, would get more tax bills from state funds. So, yeah, but I mean, at this point, it's really hard to tell how many schools statewide are going to actually, you know, adopt an ordinance like this in order to get this exemption, and it's very hard to predict.
Well, the backfill, I guess, would be not so much from schools adopting anything, but the reduction in property tax revenue, the school portion of the property tax revenue to the state general fund, and then the backfill dispersed statewide. That would be the state revenue impact, as I understand.
Just for Representative Federley, yes, that's true. And I talked about that issue with Dr. Johnson at Legislative Council because I wanted to make sure that that was not going to be a significant state burden. And his response to me was that the school districts traditionally do not the major taxing district in a region. So if they were to decide to adopt this, you wouldn't be talking about significant dollars.
And one other follow-up on that. I just want to make sure, Glenn, this is a year-to-year exemption. Is that right? Each year has to be applied for and granted?
Understandably, yes.
So the 70% average then is based on the average occupancy during the year for which the application is made?
That's right, and every facility would have to apply to SDSCs to be certified as what we're calling an essential community provider, year by year.
It would it also mean that if you had six or eight taxing districts, that if all but one went along, the deal would be off for that particular facility?
Well, Senator Strobeck, I don't believe so, because the local option reads, although there are those who are more versed in tax issues than I am, but the local option reads that the exemption applies only to the taxes of the taxing district, the governing body of which has adopted it. So if, let's say, the county and the city adopt it, but there's a special taxing district that for some reason decides not to, my understanding, and I hope to be corrected if I'm incorrect in this statement, is that the facility would be exempted from the taxes appropriated for assessed, I should say, to the county and the city, but not by the special district. And I don't mean to represent myself as a tax expert. That's my understanding. Others, please come forward and say if I'm incorrect, but I don't think so. That's the way the local option reads.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Did you have another?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Gordon. Gil Riddell?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Staff Association of Oregon Counties. I have three sets of comments on the last matter. I read the dash ones the same way. It would depend upon the taxes that would be exempted would depend upon the governing body's action. So that if a school district, for example, and I would ask Dexter or somebody outside of council, school district has ordinance making power or could adopt a resolution affecting this. School district chooses not to, the school board for the school district chooses not to, then those taxes would not be exempted. Similarly for a special district or for a city or county. So the person pursuing this exemption would have to go to each individual taxing district one at a time. Two other sets of comments. First, just as to the policy of this, it appears that the core problem is that Medicaid is covering the cost. And what this bill seeks to do is to ask local government to make up for the payment by the federal government. The Dash 1 amendments, are they an improvement over the bill? Absolutely. But speaking for the Association of Oregon Counties, we have a preferred approach that we'd rather you take. That is, with our House Bill 2039, which you heard presented to you by Multnomah County Chair Beverly Stein. In fact, and to refresh your memory, that would be for any new property tax exemption granted, funding would be provided by the state. We're so eager to approach that method that we're willing to split the difference with you and would be delighted to, given the fact that we're partners in this process and that there is good public policy that at times deals with matters of property tax exemption, we'd be involved in that process and not wanting to hamstring good public policy, that if you were to agree to amend House Bill 2039 to fund 50% of general government losses, local general government losses, we would be very much in support of that. And we'd prefer that approach over a local option approach, which we consider cumbersome and is basically sending decisions to us that often in effect are made here. So with that, that's the extent of my comments on this.
Representative Merklin.
I just want to make sure I understood your point. When you say in effect they're made here, you feel that in being given the option, counties are also compelled to make a decision in favor of the tax break?
I'm sure, Representative Merklin, not always, you know, but there often are instances where local pressures would be intense. But that's one of the roles that local governing bodies play. They have to deal with those issues. So consider that lesser of a problem.
Other questions? Thank you, Gil.
Thank you.
Mr. Simmons, you're not signed up to testify. Would you answer a question or two about some adult foster homes?
Hi, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the invitation.
Specifically, Mr. Simmons, you and I have talked about your representation of adult foster homes. I'm interested in your opinion as to if adult foster homes should be included in the language of this bill, specifically on page 1, line 27-28, where we give a definition of long-term care facility. Specifically here in the bill, it says nursing facility, assisted living facility, or a residential care facility. Do you think adult foster homes should be included in that definition and the potential property tax relief that could be granted under this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, yes, I do believe that adult foster homes ought to be included in the overall subject of property tax relief for providers furnishing long-term care to Oregon's frail and elderly citizens. And as was alluded to earlier, we do have a separate bill, House Bill 3125, which has identical language, except that it has a formula of 60% instead of 70% Medicaid occupancy. And the reason for the lower percentage is that if foster homes had to meet 70% or more residents eligible for Medicaid, that would be 4 out of 5 residents, since we have a maximum of 5 in an adult foster home. 4 out of 5 would have to be Medicaid, and you just wouldn't have hardly any homes ever eligible for that. So our approach was to endorse the concept, but make it somewhat reachable by saying 60% of the homes would have to have 60% Medicaid eligible, which would mean 3 out of 5. That would still be a very heavy Medicaid involvement, in our view. Now, so when the bill when the principal bill started in the House Human Services Committee, I testified in support of that with a caveat that there be another bill including adult foster homes. And 3125 is the companion bill, and we thank you for having that. There was a question earlier regarding the cost of the adult foster home companion bill. And there are approximately 1,950 adult foster homes in the state, and the Senior Services Division indicates that there are about between 50% and 60% have Medicaid contracts. So then we inquired how many of those Medicaid homes have 3 or more Medicaid residents in them, and there is no data available to reflect that. So it's impossible to put a cost impact statement on our bill other than what I've indicated. Lastly, we support the Dash 1 amendment, which is the local option. I recognize how technically cumbersome that is and what a burden it would be on a provider to truly get through the maze to eventually qualify for property tax relief. But nevertheless, as a concept, we support the Dash 1 amendment and the overall bill, and we hope that it receives favorable treatment from this committee, so long as it's equal treatment with adult foster homes.
So I can follow, Mr. Chair. Okay. So your preference, Mr. Simmons, is not to have the adult foster homes included in House Bill 2079, but to have a separate bill for adult foster homes, namely House Bill 3125.
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, I don't want to rain on another gentleman's bill. Obviously, what I would like the adult foster homes to be included in the principal bill, but if that's not practical at this moment, as a matter of good faith, I would hope that this committee would come back and truly address the adult foster home section of the total problem.
Mr. Chair.
Jane Merkley.
I'd like to ask, if this has already been clarified, someone can speak to me privately, and I won't take the committee's time, but in the local exemption on Dash 1, or the local option, would, if all the taxing districts except for, say, 2 in a particular unitary district approved it, would it still engage, or does it have to have the unanimous support of the taxing districts?
Representative, we have covered that.
Okay.
Yeah. You want to answer that?
Representative Merkley, you do not need all of the taxing districts to approve it in order for it to be effective. It's effective for each taxing district once they approve it.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Chair. Before we go into the work session, we're going to take about a 10-minute recess. We'll come back at 9:40. Recess. Seeing no one, close the public hearing on 2079 and open a work session on House Bill 2079.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapori.
I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2079.
Representative Kapori moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2079. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kapori.
I move House Bill 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kapori moves House Bill 2079 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Please call the roll.
Yes, Roland.
Aye.
Excuse.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Kelly.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen.
Excuse.
Chair Strobeck.
Aye.
Representative Merkley or Rasmussen right outside the door.
Rasmussen votes aye.
Okay.
Bill 2079 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Aye.
And Representative Kapori will, would you like to carry the bill?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2079. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2080. First time we've seen this bill, so Ed, will you summarize it for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2080 creates a non-refundable personal and corporate income tax credit based on premiums paid for long-term care insurance.
Okay. Gwen Deaton.
Good morning again. Chair Strobeck, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gwen Deaton from the Oregon Healthcare Association. As Mr. Watt has indicated, this is a bill that provides a tax credit towards the cost to purchase the policy of long-term care insurance. And more specifically, what this does is provide a credit in the amount of 15% with a cap of $500 towards the cost of a premium for long-term care policies, and it's available to an individual who purchases the policy or to an employer who purchases the policy on behalf of employees. There is also a section in this bill that requires senior staple services to work with the Department of Consumer and Business Services in educating Oregonians about the need to plan for their long-term care needs, do that planning include insurance or any other thing that may be appropriate for any individual. The reason that we're here before you this morning with this bill is because Oregon's baby boomers are growing older.
That's obvious. That's a reply of the day.
Every 8 seconds, another person turns 50 years old. And almost none of us, none of us have any of us here at any time, but half of those people are going to need long-term care.
Representative,
I do wish to point out that Gen Xers are also growing older.
Chair Rasmussen, we are all growing older. Some of us feel older every second as the day goes on. but it is the people who are in their 40s and 50s who are going to affect this state and impose incredible needs on this state. As I said, almost half the people that are 50 years old and older will need long-term care. And in the next 30 years or so, the number of people that are over 85 in this state is going to increase 4 times. And that is significant because people over the age of 85 are the largest users of long-term care. So we're going to see a dramatic increase in the need for long-term care services in this state. We as individuals are not scared. Only 3% of Oregonians and affect nations of true nationwide have long-term care insurance. And this is astounding given the number of us that will actually use long-term care. None of us would dream of going without fire insurance on our house. But we only have a 1 in 1,200 chance to actually get insurance. We have an almost 50-50 chance of meeting long-term care services, but only 3% of us have prepared for this by purchasing insurance. Most baby boomers think that, incorrectly, that Medicare will cover long-term care. It doesn't. There's a very limited long-term care benefit. Or they think that their personal savings will cover any long-term care needs that they have. This isn't true either. There was a poll done that was astounding to me. On average, baby boomers have saved only $34,000 for their retirement. That won't cover 1 year of care in a nursing facility. So, we have not saved enough to cover our long-term care needs. And in fact, the failure to prepare for the cost of long-term care is the primary cause of impoverishment among older people. So we, as individuals, have not considered our long-term care needs, have not cared for them in any respect. Not only have we not purchased insurance, but we haven't taken any other steps to prepare for what will be a likely need. But the state is also not prepared for the dramatic increase in the need for long-term care. As we discussed in the context of 2079, Medicaid is the major purchaser of long-term care in Oregon today. And Medicaid is already strained in meeting the existing need. It already is not keeping up with the increasing cost to provide long-term care. And if we don't do something to decrease the reliance on Medicaid to pay for long-term care, we're going to see tripling of Medicaid caseloads in the next 30 years. We're going to see spending in this state on Medicaid equaling, very conservatively, probably higher than this, $5 billion by the year 2030. In making this even more frightening, we're going to have more and more people relying on Medicaid benefits and fewer younger people paying into the system. So we're facing incredible strains on the system, and we don't want to see Medicaid, which was originally developed as a safety net for the truly impoverished low-income among us, be taken away as a safety net for even those people. We need to encourage those who can afford to address their own long-term care needs by purchasing long-term care insurance to do so. We are hopeful that this bill, by one, educating Oregonians about their needs plan, and two, providing an incentive to them to purchase long-term care insurance, that we will begin to address the need for long-term care and begin to address the incredible strains our system is going to face in the coming years. If only one-third of those people over 35 purchase long-term care insurance, we will save $202 million by the biennium beginning in 2029, and of course incremental savings every year leading up to that year. So we can take action to diminish the burdens on our system, but we have to do that now. Now is the time that we have to start encouraging people in their 30s and 40s, younger people, to purchase long-term care insurance. So when they get to an age where they will have a need for that, that they will have a need to pay for it rather than spending down and relying on Medicaid. Medicaid is a unique system in that sense that it, unlike other safety nets for low-income Oregonians, Medicaid is a system that has become the long-term care insurance of choice. People that have lived their lives as middle-income Oregonians and upper-income Oregonians, if they need long-term care as they grow older, they end up impoverishing themselves and relying on Medicaid, unlike other systems that truly are safety nets for low-income people. We can't have that continue and have Medicaid provide the kind of care that we will all need and deserve as we grow older. So we urge you to consider passage of this bill, and I will answer any questions you have.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Attorney Murphy?
Briefing refers to Oregon's tax deduction for long-term care insurance. Do you happen to have the number of that tax deduction? I've been trying to locate it.
Just so that Representative Murphy, the statute number?
Or the tax expenditure report number of it.
I can certainly get you the ORS number. It's buried in my stack of things here, and if I can't find it in the next 2 seconds, I'll get back to you. It's ORS, I want to say 307 point something, but I can get that for you. Yes, and there is, Representative Merkley raised a good point, there is a deduction on the ORS statutes right now that applies only to people that are over 62 years of age. And the way this bill is written is you take the deduction or you take the credit. You don't take both. I will be happy to get that statute. Is the statute number what you're looking for?
Or no, I was really just trying to find a report on the deduction.
And Representative Murphy, I think Mr. Waters has that.
Representative Murphy, item 1.092 on page 101 in the tax expenditure report, that's the additional medical deductions for the elderly, which is the Oregon portion of that.
I was just looking at that, and I didn't see any reference to long-term care insurance. Perhaps it's in it does give full deduction for all medical expenses.
That's right, Representative Merkley. Long-term care insurance is considered now a medical expense, pursuant to Sandy Kassenbaum that passed on a federal level a few years ago.
Okay, that clarifies. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gwen, you and I have had several conversations about this idea, and it's one that, frankly, I'm favorably disposed towards. Obviously, the challenge, I think, for all of us is on this committee, not that it's a bad idea, but that in a committee that has been searching for tax credits we could dispose of, we seem to be more interested in creating new ones than getting rid of old ones, and that's a concern. And I guess maybe for the benefit of the committee, I'll ask a question that you've already somewhat shared the answer with me, but that is, to what degree, if any, do you think this will actually incentivize people of my age and even considerably younger people like Representative Kapori to go out and purchase long-term care insurance?
Just about Representative Williams, it's a good question, and it's a question that's difficult to answer because it's difficult to predict human behavior. Other states have adopted a similar credit to this, but they've only adopted it in the last few years, and so we don't have those states to rely on as an indicator of what people will do. What I can also say is that in the polling that was done at Baby Boomers that I referred to earlier, they've indicated a willingness to spend $31 a month on long-term care insurance. Now, that's not quite enough. It's enough, frankly, if you're in your 30s, which is a low-end policy. It's not quite enough if you're a little bit older than that. And we're hopeful that at least there's an indication of a willingness to spend some money on it, that if we can throw a few more dollars their way, that will be enough to put people over the top, to consider purchasing long-term care insurance.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
What do you think about the idea? I mean, there are obviously some very, prudent people out there already who've seen the benefit of this concept. My guess is likely they've maybe lived through this situation with maybe a parent or a grandparent. They've recognized the cost. They've already gone out on their own and purchased this policy. What are your thoughts about not covering them under some, I mean, people who've already, who we don't need to give an incentive to go out and buy it because they already understand the need for it. What do you think about not covering them under an approach like this, but only allowing essentially, new folks who you can actually track even to some degree the award for tax credit as having the impact?
Just so that Representative Williams, that certainly is an idea to consider, because then you would truly be giving the credit only to people who need to be incentivized, who need that little boost to get them over the top to agree to purchase long-term care insurance. So that certainly is something to consider.
Representative Henry.
I wasn't going to comment on that, but to follow up, doesn't that also penalize people who thought ahead
Representative Federley, it does say to them, thank you for making a responsible decision, and we're going to encourage others to do the same.
Definitely
reward them for that.
Mm, yeah, but you lose.
Yeah. I'm counseling on policy now.
Yeah. And now to my real question, I was curious to know the assumptions that went into the revenue impact statement on those lines. That is, if Ed could share with us what his assumptions were in generating the statement here of 8.4 in the next biennium and 20 million thereafter, who you assumed was going to be signing up.
Representative Shirley, they note at the bottom of that kind of builds in the baseline.
But I guess 50,000, age-wise, what does that translate into? Is that capturing the over 50 crowd, or is it
Representative Shirley, the data, I guess, is based on distribution of taxpayers in the 50 to 65 range who use the additional medical deduction for elderly taxpayers over 62. It was a real problem getting reliable data for doing this calculation. And that starting point, 50,000 policies in the first tax year, that's probably on the high side, I would think. I expect that, especially if employers were providing, were able to provide this and get a tax credit for it, that subscription rate would increase pretty rapidly when that started to phase in. But in the beginning years, that 50,000 figure is probably on the high side.
Sure. Back to this question of the goal of incentivizing behavior. A different strategy would be to offer a larger tax credit the first year that someone signs up for this insurance, which would get people familiar with it, with the concept and have a relationship with the company and so on and so forth. Also, the costs are undoubtedly lower in the early year because costs go up with each year you age, I assume. Is that an approach that might have been talked about?
Sure, but Representative Murphy, no, that's a good point. We have not discussed doing a graduated tax credit. That certainly is something that we can consider. There are, as you phrase, there are a number of different ways we can consider doing this. Representative Williams has raised another one, particularly as we look to managing or reducing the U.S. impact of this in this era of tight money. So we're open to any suggestions that might help us to do that or make it a more effective tax credit without increasing the burden on the state.
Okay. Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair Quinn. The revenue impact approximates about 50,000 policies that exist in Oregon right now. Do you know how those break down as far as ones that are implied are made available through employers versus ones purchased individually?
I'm sure that Representative Rosenbaum. No, I don't, but the person who might is Peggy Annett, who is here and will testify on that. She has more hands-on knowledge of insurance and how it's offered than I do.
And then second question, Mr.
Sure.
Chair. Also, whether you know or not, maybe Peggy will, this is a fairly extensive kind of insurance, obviously, given that a lot of people don't have health insurance in this state. Do you know what income levels people are covered by these policies? And I'm just questioning whether a 15% tax credit would enable people to purchase insurance that's going to cost $1,800 a year on average if they're at a lower income level. Still fairly expensive.
Just so that Representative Rosenbaum, it is expensive if you purchase it at, well, pretty qualified that if you're a very low-income person, anything is expensive. So I don't mean to disregard that concern. But if you are in your purchasing it at a relatively early age, long-term care insurance is not that expensive. You can purchase it for between $300 and $500 a year if you're purchasing it in your 30s and early 40s. It's when you start trying to buy it when you're 65 and older that it becomes more like, you know, $2,000 to $5,000 a year that it does become worth. I don't know if that answers your concern or not.
I guess what I was really asking is who is purchasing this insurance right now in terms of income levels? Do you have, if you know?
And I, Chair Schroeder, Representative Rosenbaum, I don't have those breakdowns. I know, and I think Peggy might be able to elaborate more on this than I can, that currently purchases of long-term care insurance tend to be older. And it's one of the hopes with this bill is that we'll encourage younger people to purchase it when it is less expensive and it's more affordable.
Okay. Thank you very much. Dean Kortke and Peggy Annett.
Thank you, Representative Strobeck. For the record, my name is Dean Kortke. The testimony is being handed out to you. Unfortunately, I'm a kind of a working stiff guy and a volunteer. I drove up last night, and I thought this was going to be the House Human Resources Committee, but by the time I got home about 8 o'clock last night and got a message, it's another committee, so I hope I haven't offended you with this. I am here today representing the Oregon Life Underwriters Association, which is a group of 1,500 or so professional life and health agents in Oregon, and we're here to support the concept of this bill, the dollars and cents. You all get to make that decision. So I've got some testimony. You've gotten some numbers about the need for this kind of insurance. There's no doubt that that's coming down the pike, and Medicare is not going to be there to handle it. I just addressed some questions that came up that were proposed by Gwen, some comments about who buys this stuff. It's not very commonly purchased. It's not done by groups yet, so it's not very large as a group benefit. That's starting to happen. I'm a professional insurance agent in our agency in Eugene. We deal with about 650 employers in this area, and of all those employers, only 3 have purchased this. So this is not something that people are knocking down doors to buy at. To give you an idea of the price, if this bill was passed the way it is for me, I'd be very appreciative because I would have saved $240 on my taxes this year. It was a nice little gift. The premium for me and my wife is right at $1,600 for both of us, and I'm not 40 years old, so but that's for 2 of us. So that would have saved me, you know, if we use a 15% of $500 deal, that would have saved me $240 and both myself and my wife's taxes. We think it's a great idea. I would really just comment on one thing and let Peggy maybe answer some questions for you, and that is probably makes some sense to try to find some way to stimulate some thought about this in the last part of the bill, which would require, or however that's actually done in the government, Senior Disabled Service Division, along with Department of Consumer Business Services, to do some kind of a program to let this information be known. We work very carefully, our association with the Insurance Commission, a very close relationship, and we'd be glad to commit our volunteers and our agents out there to help do this. I think that's an important part of what this says. You all got to cut the money deal, and that's a tough decision. And yeah, I'd appreciate your $500. Thank you very much. Whether or not that really flies, but it's a great concept, I think. I don't know if it's really going to stimulate people. I don't think people buy because of tax credits. I really don't think they do that.
Good morning, Chair Strobeck, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett. Excuse me. I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I'm not going to deal with the testimony that I've actually handed out, except to make one point, and that is to clarify or elucidate for you what actually is eligible for long-term care coverage in Oregon, which I think is an important fact to understand as part of this discussion. In Oregon, actually, long-term care coverage provides for in-home care, including respite care, coverage for assisted living facilities, nursing home facilities, and the in-home services that one may want to avail themselves of in order to stay in their home as long as possible. So I want to disabuse you of the idea that when we talk about long-term care, we are not just talking about nursing home care. And you probably know that Oregon has been a leader in the area of trying to design options not only through the Medicaid program, but also through the regulated long-term care insurance products that are available, induce the development of programs that will keep people in their homes as long as possible. And I do have some information on that I could make available. I would like to point out that Oregon also has been a leader in terms of what the Department of Consumer and Business Services has done in developing information for potential purchasers, explaining what the services are and the kind of consumer protections that already exist in Oregon statute. What I wanted to get to were some of the discussions about how to design a plan, how to deal with some of the cost consequences. In fact, interestingly enough, the Health Insurance Association of America has done some work specifically on the question of who buys long-term care insurance. And I didn't bring sufficient copies of this app, but I will make those available to the committee members. Interestingly enough, in terms of the factors that were identified as significant in inducing non-purchasers to purchase long-term care, if the premium were tax deductible, actually was the number one factor, and at least people reported as being an incentive for them to purchase long-term care. That was at a 35% response that they would find that a factor to change their mind towards purchasing. That was actually over a risk factor if a person knew that they were likely to have to use long-term care. I think that gets to the point that people are not willing to deal with having to go into a nursing home or take advantage of those kinds of services until it's immediately on them. They see it off in the future. But aside from that debate, a tax incentive is clearly seen as a motivating factor in getting people to look at long-term care. One of the things that was also discussed is how else do you get people to offer long-term care? One of the reasons specifically that we put the employer-provided provision in the statute was to encourage employer-based offerings. Presently, on a national basis, there are about 6 million long-term care policies. However, there are only 1,500 employers in a national survey that report offering long-term care coverage. It's a very low number. Last session, Tim Carlson and I worked on a bill to get Deb to offer long-term care offerings and long-term care policies, and Representative Strobeck is aware of the efforts that are underway in PEBS to make that available to public employees. One of our motives in doing that was to provide that as an incentive for employers to use that as a model to see that that becomes something that is more prevalent out there. And one of the things that is interesting about the employer offering, the survey that I mentioned that reported 1,500 employers offering it, 52% of those employers actually had 100 or fewer employees, which is really an interesting observation, because it is clear that those employers, it's the smaller employers that have moved towards offering this, and I suspect it's largely driven by the personal experience. I served as a benefits manager previously, and what I find is the people who are most interested in buying long-term care, aside from the tax incentive, are those individuals who had to deal with a special family situation. That's when they begin to realize that they want to start making those decisions. Mm-hmm. If you have it available as an employer option, then you start really, I think, getting to the 30 and 40-year-olds as buying it when they know that it becomes available. And that gets to the kind of revenue impact that Ed has developed, and I think he did a yeoman's effort, but it is extremely difficult to deal with the fiscal, because we're actually operating on the basis of imputed numbers. And we're operating on the basis of imputed numbers, focusing on an older population, when in fact what we're trying to do is target a younger population to get them to buy the product. Going to Representative Merkley's idea of a graduated tax credit, although I have personally considered that and had discussions about it, the rub that we got into on that discussion is we didn't want to provide a higher incentive for younger individuals to buy it when it was most affordable at the expense of the people that are the 65 plus categories that have the higher long-term care premium. I think in terms of our considerations, that we will potentially ask revenue staff to take a look at options of perhaps a couple of these, such as limiting it to new policy owners, taking a look at the graduated premium credit approach, as well as taking a look at restricting it to an employer-based kind of package. I can tell you that with the employer-based package, that would probably take at least the foreseeable revenue impact down to a very low number, just given the current way that the product is offered. And when we considered that, we really did not want to discourage people to buy in the individual market as they presently do. In response to Representative Rosenbaum's questions about who buys this product, in fact, what you see is that this is the type of an option that is really for those people who have modest or above incomes. It is not a policy that will actually serve the individuals who are at the low income arena, and that's recognized in terms of the national association that I work for. And what we're trying to do is delineate the responsibilities for the Medicaid program and direct people who have the means to assume greater personal responsibility at a younger age and buy something that will actually also enable them to have a healthcare or long-term care product that will cover those kind of nursing home, in-home care services when they get to the point of potentially needing them. I should also point out that these kinds of plans are very important for those individuals who happen to have some sort of a catastrophic injury at an early age and need some sort of nursing home care or rehab care. So there also are individuals who are at a much younger age that would benefit from this kind of approach by having a long-term care policy. Just with that, as I said, I abandoned my prepared remarks, but what I tried to do was cover a range of issues that a number of you have raised. I think it is a serious issue, and when you look at on the federal level, all of the attention is focusing on how to deal with the Medicare costs. At the same time, at the federal level, they realize that nursing homes, long-term care issues are very significant, but at least at this juncture, I see nothing in the foreseeable future that suggests that there will be any congressional action to deal with the nursing home long-term care needs that are going to be facing the baby boomer population, not being a generous Generation X or person myself.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you, Peggy. Let's finish
up. Thank you. I apologize. I may have missed this when I stepped out, but in your comments to the effect that this tax credit would primarily be used by middle to upper income taxpayers, that raises a question in my mind then, I guess, that I haven't thought before. Is this benefit primarily going to people who probably wouldn't end up in the Medicaid system anyway, and will it not incentivize people who, because of their low income status, are probably going to end up there, or they're more likely to end up in the Medicaid system? Looking at Gwen gave us the figures here, the $4.8 billion in Medicaid savings, I guess the question is, will we still have substantially that number, even with a program like this, if the benefits are taken by people who probably wouldn't go into Medicaid in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, the answer to your question is no, you're not likely to see a population that would be able to afford it. And the key point that we're trying to make is that when you take a look at the expense of long-term care, people will not, even people of modest incomes, actually even people of upper modest income, will not have sufficient resources to cover long-term care should they need it 20 or 30 years down the road. Gwen made the comment in her testimony that the current savings for the baby boomer population presently is about $34,000. In fact, the projections to the 2020 in that area, actually discussions about annual costs in a nursing home, I've seen some numbers that have suggested it's going to be in the $200,000, $300,000 range on an annual basis for a skilled nursing situation. And even now, I know having dealt with a relative, the monthly cost for skilled nursing was in the area of $4,000 a month. And so consequently, when you take a look at this kind of a plan, it is those people who have modest means but not extraordinary means. That is specifically the people that will be most benefited, and those are the people that are most likely to be confronted with the situation of essentially doing it intentionally or otherwise, spending down their assets in order to get into Medicaid.
Mr. Chair, if I could add to that, I think I'd agree with Peggy. I think you probably find people in that whatever that range of income with Oregon's fairly high income tax, that would be a higher incentive to them, frankly, than someone in a higher income. So I really think the result of this really would incentivize that, I don't know how to classify that, but that lower middle income group really began purchasing that. It's probably bigger number.
And I think what, you know, just to be sure that we're all clear on this, what we're trying to do is design an incentive that helps protect the kinds of resources that will have to be focused on truly the lower income needy folks, and include or develop a new strategy for getting people who at this juncture are not buying this kind of a product. And it has to be, we're talking about different forms of carrots, not the least of which is the educational situation that was discussed.
Okay, William.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I know we're running short on time, but I guess I'd just say, you know, I don't know what the answer is in general. I do know that the evidence, we know for sure that this population is going to continue to grow as we all age. And we are really going to, I think, as a state, if we don't start dealing with this issue, we are going to enter a period of time when we will be, quite frankly, in a generational warfare, where we are placing the burdens on the backs of the younger people in our society who are out working and paying the taxes. And we will be in a battle between funding education and funding programs that will take care of this aging population if we don't provide some need for them to take care of themselves. We're getting close to that now, quite frankly. It's only going to get worse. And again, I'm not sure. This is a tough revenue impact to swallow, and I recognize that. But we've got to start somewhere.
Mr. Chair, would you like us to work with staff on coming back with three, or examining three options that have been discussed here in terms of potentially reducing the revenue impact?
I think that's a good idea. I think that is a rather substantial hit when we look at that. So even though it's President Williams says it's a good issue, we need to take a look at it in a little different light.
Okay.
Rosenwald.
I'd suggest if we're going to look at different options, maybe a means testing would also be one to look at as a way of reducing the revenue impact, given the discussion we just had about who we're trying to target with that.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate your discussion and certainly appreciate bringing the idea forward, and we'll look forward to hearing it again. Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2080. I want to tell the committee what we plan to do. We've got two people to speak on House Bill 2947, the tax credit bill, and then tomorrow we have a whole list of bills listed. Don't worry about it. Those are just for the public hearing ones are just for gavel tap purposes. We're not going to take testimony on those. They're just to get them into the hopper. But what I hope to do tomorrow is to start going through the, I believe the tax credits are up tomorrow, aren't they, Paul? No? Never mind. I think that's Monday then. We'll start going through those. And I want to just go through each one of them. I'd like all members to be here. So we're going to do it very democratically. The majority of the members speaking on any one particular tax credit, the majority rules, and then we'll incorporate those all into the final amendment. So be prepared to be here if you have an interest in either saving or eliminating a particular tax credit. And today will be the last day we'll take public testimony. We have Don Schellenberg and Link Cannon. So if you guys could take care of that real quickly, Link will take you first. Before I open the public hearing on that, I want to chair request unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Representative Merkley to cast a vote on House Bill 2079. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Merkley, how do you vote?
Aye.
Both aye. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2947. Link.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Link Cannon. I am the Director of Forest Resources and Taxation for the Oregon Forest Industry Council, and I am here to testify today on the item in the bill, which is the reforestation tax credit. I had testimony on this from the Board of Forestry the other day, talking about what it does, and I won't go into all of that, how it works. We did have a board meeting earlier this week, and we reviewed with our board their level of support for the reforestation tax credit, and I was frankly surprised how broadly how many companies use it. I personally was under the impression that there are some companies that very specifically target opportunities in converting. And let me say just up front, it's reforestation tax credit is really kind of a misnomer. because reforestation is required under law when you harvest a sand, and so that is reforestation. This is really a sand conversion tax credit. In other words, it takes stands that are in brush or underproductive land and converts them to productive forest land. And the reason for the tax credit is this is a much more expensive thing to do. When you harvest trees, you plan for your reforestation as part of your harvest activities, and so it may cost you $200 an acre to reestablish a stand on that site. You have to go in and take out brush and prepare the site for planting. It can run for $500 or more an acre to reestablish a stand. And so the reason for the tax credit is to encourage that kind of behavior. But anyway, our board, there are quite a few companies that do use it. And if you look at the tax expenditure report, you'll actually see that I think it's mostly corporations that use it. The advantages of it, I guess, are that it does one of two things. It either encourages, makes financially feasible conversions, which otherwise would not take place. And I know of some companies that do specialize in that. One in particular down in the Roseburg area, they had their forester come up several years ago and give a presentation to this committee on the how they use that tax credit, and they were aggressively buying underproductive lands and converting them to forest lands. Other larger companies, it will be a factor in their decision as to whether to convert a stand today, tomorrow, or in 10 years as to how cost-effective that is and how that competes internally with the other uses of that money. So it can either cause conversions to take place that would otherwise not take place, or it can accelerate conversions that would take place sometime further in the future. I think the most interesting thing, or maybe one way of thinking about this, is in the tax expenditure report. It's noted in the Department of Forestry analysis that this expenditure is basically $50 that you invest today on average per acre, and the return in that in terms of increased taxes that come off productive forest lands is $400. And that is I haven't seen the analysis, but I presume that's in present dollars. So it really is an investment in the future. If these lands aren't growing trees, then they're not going to be producing revenues and jobs and all the other good things that come off productive forest lands. So, based on the position our board took, I wanted to share with you that we strongly support the reforestation tax credit. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Schoenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Don Schoenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Probably no mystery why I'm here, and probably no mystery about the issues that are concerned us. I wish I probably would have taped other years, because I probably could just do the same thing. Nothing really has changed. Farm prices keep coming down. We're down 9 cent hogs, and that's depression era prices. Wheat down in the bottom of the ship somewhere. Grass seed is backing off because of the Asian flu, financial flu, that is. One thing after the next, and all the while our costs seem to keep going up. Most recently, the fuel tax, or not the tax, that hasn't gone up yet, has it? They're talking about it, so
come back and talk.
All right, come back and talk about that. But the fuel itself, and of course fuel is a main component for some of the fertilizers that are produced. So it's just that spread between income and expenses just keeps widening, it seems. And so the reason I say that is just to point out the need and the incentive that these particular tax credits provide. And that may not only help the farmer. In the case, I want to mention particularly the farmer for housing credit. There's an issue. It's the carrot instead of the stick approach kind of thing, but yet while it helps the farmer, it also helps the employee. And we're certainly needing employees. That's another issue we won't get into at the federal level on workers that are needed. Crop greening program, another issue, helps those people who are in need of food, gives the farmer some incentive to allow them onto the land or whatever it takes to take some of the crop that they aren't otherwise able to get any financial benefit from. And then the alternatives to the field burning issue. We have eliminated field burning probably to the greatest extent that we're going to. There's always some that we have to do, but that has in no way diminished the amount of grass seed straw that's out there. You still have to dispose of the grass seed straw. And the alternatives to that and the tax credit provided for that is what's necessary to get that done. So I would just like to offer our support in addition to others probably that have already mentioned these issues. And if they haven't, they better, because they are important issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We can assume that anything that's farm-related, we want to keep. Is that right?
That's true, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Right. And anything else you know, you'd like to add? Oh.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The committee's adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow.